Okay, move out.
You're listening to the Valor Podcast with Nick Lehman, a show highlighting the people who defend the United States of America and those who support them.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello and welcome to the Valor Podcast. Have you ever met that person that just does not quit? That you're like, man, it's really hard times ahead. And they're like, don't quit. You better not quit. You better not quit. Well, there's a person that I can't wait to tell you about in a minute. But first, I want to thank our show sponsors, Booyah Media. They have helped us with our website and online support and some back-end stuff for making the ValorPodcast.com go. So you can see their work at BooyahMedia.com. That is BooyahMedia.com. Our guest today is retired United States Army Staff Sergeant Travis Mills of the 82nd Airborne, who has turned his post-military career into motivational speaking. He's also an author and advocate for veterans and amputees. He has a best-selling memoir called Tough as They Come. I tell you, I read the book. It's a fabulous read. It talks about his life history and overcoming being a quadruple amputee from an improvised explosive device in Afghanistan. Travis, it is a pleasure to have you on, and thank you so much for all you do for our military families and even your families.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on with the show. You just do great work with this podcast, and I'm just honored to be a guest.
Cool. Well, thank you, sir. So, we're part of a generation that had a lot of military members become a part of it. From 2001 all the way to now. The one aspect I loved in your book is that no military service is above any other warrior. I love that principle. Why did you think it was important to put that in the book?
Well, I just thought that, there's nothing better than military service, and everybody did their part, and I'm just thankful that I had the opportunity to go ahead and be part of the brotherhood that is the military.
And you talk about the brotherhood. What is that like? I mean, I know I'm a civilian, so I'll never experience the brotherhood of going to combat or even, going in peacetime.
Well, you're fortunate when you go into the military that, one, you're from a small town like I was, or you're from a big city, but when you go into the military, there's nobody there you know. And you have to bond with these people that are from across this great nation, and you have some friendships like you never have before. And then it gets even tighter because when you go overseas, that's the person that is responsible to look out for your left or your right and to keep you alive. So the brotherhood is there because you know that without them, the mission fails, and without you, the mission fails. So it's all a cohesive unit that depends on each other, whether you like each other or not back in the States, as friends to hang out on the weekends, or maybe you despise each other when you're overseas and, bullets are flying by, you know that person's got your back no matter what, and you would take a bullet for them to make sure that they can continue the mission.
Oh, man, that's awesome. I watched a documentary one time, and they had that same concept, and the guy's like, I absolutely hate that guy. Like, I can't stand him. He, like, steals the best MREs. He does all these things, but I want him in a firefight.
I had a guy that, in a firefight, I went out and, picked him up and took him out of it because he tore his ACL and MCL and MCL. He tore all of his knee out. And you know what? I didn't really get along with him back in the States. Me and him butted heads, and we weren't friends on the weekends. We weren't friends at work. We were the same rank. And when push come to shove, though, he went down in a huge firefight, mortars dropping around him, bullets whizzing by him. He needed help. I went ahead and threw my M4 to my first sergeant. I ran down and picked him up, and we ran out of combat, the battle space together, because that's what you do for somebody that's wearing the same uniform, that has the American values, and is your brother in arms.
That's incredible. I mean, I love that concept, and I wish even civilians and here in the States that we could understand that type of mentality that, there's one common goal, wherever we're at, whether it's a baseball team or a Fortune 500 company.
Well, I mean, that's what they drill into you, during basic training. When you go to dinner, they're like, one team, one fight, And then, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest link, so everybody wants everybody to do the best. It's not a competition really about who's the best that day in combat. It's about everybody doing their best so everybody can come home alive or come home safe and make sure that everybody's working towards that one common goal. When I went overseas, you know, I didn't go for anything except for the guy on my left and my right. I mean, our nation asked us to go, and we would go, obviously, willingly, because that's what we signed up for. But when you went over there, you cared about your soldiers, you cared about the men and their families back home, and you knew that they were depending on you as much as you're depending on them so that you can get back home to your family.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was picking up on that in the book that, you know, that you guys had all that common coming back home and being safe. And, you know, the big umbrella was fighting for the USA, but the, you know, the day to day, it was like, that's my brother and sister in arms, you know?
Absolutely. When we got our orders to go over our third deployment, I had orders taking me to Fort Hood, Texas. They were trying to tell me that I had to go and be restationed at Fort Hood, Texas. And I went to my sergeant major and I said, you know, it's not fair to these young privates that are from California and Maine and Michigan and all over this nation that come in, they look up to me and I train them and I tell them how to fight. I tell them what to do in combat and I'm their leader and they're someone that they respect. And now you're telling me that when you're about to go overseas, I have to go to Fort Hood. So I went ahead and talked to my sergeant major and I said, you know, I'll go to Fort Hood if I have to. I understand orders, but if I can go overseas in this deployment, my wife understands it. She knows that these are the guys I look after. And I don't think it's right that I'm getting out of a deployment because, you know, they deserve to have me as much as I deserve to go over with them after all the training. And my sergeant major said, okay, I'll take care of it. So I really didn't have to go on my third deployment. If I would have went to Fort Hood, I'd probably still have arms and legs. But you know what? I don't dwell in the past. I reminisce the past, and I can't change what happened. But I was fortunate that I had that kind of bond with my men that where I wanted to go. I didn't want to get out of deployment. I didn't want to try to hide out or do anything different except for go overseas with them.
Yeah, that's totally. I mean, you develop those relationships, and you're like, I just can't let them go. You know, that's awesome. So I want to ask it, you know, you've seen a lot of leaders within the military, and you were one of them too. I liked your style in the book and, you know, all the stuff I've read, but do you think a leader can be appointed, or is there more trial by fire kind of figuring out how to lead this group?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different styles of leadership. You know, some guys have been brought up to where yelling and screaming and shouting and, you know, to their face goes blue is how they lead. And that's their approach. My approach was a lot different. I was kind of calm, cool, and collected, laughing and joking. And that way, if I ever did get mad, they knew they really messed up. And I played the role more of, you know, like of a parent when someone was like, I'm really disappointed in you and you feel terrible about it. Worse than any yelling or screaming that they could ever do. And I just was in a unit as a young private where I was treated like a grown-up, and I didn't have to go through the hazing, if you will, or anything like that. So everybody's a different style of leader. I always made sure my guys slept the most, ate the fruit, you know, they ate first. They were always taken care of. Anything I could get them out of where it was kind of pointless work, I would. And, you know, they would make sure they took care of me too. And when I got blown up, I was a pretty heavy guy. I was 250 pounds with my you know, that was just very regular, so I had about another 150 pounds of gear, so I had to know that if I got hurt, they were going to make the effort to carry me out, and, you know, they did carry me out. So I just, there's different styles of leadership. I chose a different one, and I think it was rewarding in itself because I got put in higher positions because of how I led from the front, and I was happy with the abilities that the Army gave me.
So I got to ask. So you mentioned you're you know kind of having it as the parent style. Did you have the Staff Sergeant Mills parent look, like you looked at whoever was messing up and everything just got fixed right away? You know, that magical parental power that some of us have.
I mean, there was one or two privates I've had, you know, that were problems. They were just problems from day one, and you just can't. Sometimes you just can't fix it. But yeah, I mean, there was. You know, if I wouldn't have to yell or scream or shout. I would just make a comment, and they'd be like, "I didn't know that. That's not, you know, it was real quick." And I mean, that's good. I had one time that someone heard me yell, and nobody knew I even knew how to yell, I guess. But I yelled at one of my privates, and it was echoing through the place. And they were like, "Oh my gosh, who's that yelling? That sounds ridiculously scary." And someone said, oh, that's Sergeant Mills. And they're like, oh my gosh, Sergeant Mills, that's how he yells? And they said, yeah, if he yells, though, you've really done something. Like, you have messed up really, really bad. And nobody wanted to see that side of me. I'm happy-go-lucky. You know, no one wants to see my angry, mad. No, that's not a side I like to show.
Don't poke the grizzly bear.
Exactly. And my, you know, my daughter, I'm never going to yell at her like that, I hope. And my wife, I've never raised my voice to my wife ever. I'm very proud of that fact, never saying anything derogatory towards her. I don't think it solves anything. So if I'm yelling to fix a problem, you know that they've done something where I think that's the last resort.
I like it. I like the style in a similar way. So, you know, a lot of people, we sent guys to Iraq and girls to Iraq and Afghanistan, and it just kind of came to the back burner of people's thoughts. And now recently I've kind of started to understand how remote these areas were. Like, I was reading that you guys didn't have showers or hot meals in some extended times. And, you know, the hot meal was an MRE. You guys were pretty remote.
Well, I mean, we were pushed out. We were taking Taliban compounds, and then we'd hold it, and then someone would come in and fill in, and then we'd take another Taliban compound. So, yeah, we were, you know, drinking water and having MREs every day. And, you know, we had showers, if you consider a water bottle, and you poke holes in the top of the tip of your knife and then spray it on yourself. But let me tell you something. In the March, February time frame, when it's below freezing and the water's ice cold and you can't warm it up, you just decide, you know what, I'm gonna hold off on this today, and I'll just go with the smell. But, yeah, I took four real showers. I took four real showers in 1 year, but it's so good for your skin. I mean, you're actually thankful. You keep that regimen. I still take four showers in a year, so it's all good. No, I'm just kidding, obviously, but.
That's awesome. Yeah, and some body spray, right?
Oh, yeah, a little bit of that. But, you know, it's just, you know, they got these things called, Ranger panties. They're kind of like silk short shorts. And you pack 12 pair of those, and every month you throw one away. And that's all you do. You wear them for a month, and you throw them away.
that little insight with Travis here. I love it. So the thing that kind of is hard to understand, I think everybody has a problem understanding, is all the factions over there with the Taliban, and you have other, you know, tribal kind of things. And sometimes the tribes would just flip on you. Like, they would just, you know, they would get paid off or anything like that. Was that hard to win the hearts and minds of these guys, especially like the kids and the women that you're trying to help and make their country better?
I mean, yes and no. It's hard, but at the same time, you go in there and you're kind of, you do your best. You're polite. You're friendly. You always have that look ready to, you know, at the moment's notice, if someone gets after you, you get after them. But it's hard because they know we're going to leave. Eventually, we're going to have to go home, and they have to live with the Taliban. And then as the rules of engagements got more strict and absurd, it got harder for us to really lead with it a good example, because we would, you know, go out during the day and go back at nighttime, and then we weren't allowed to go out at nighttime anymore. So we couldn't go out and try to stop the Taliban from moving around the battlefield, which I watched them on a raid camera, put IEDs in the ground. And we couldn't go out and get them because it was nighttime. We couldn't drop mortars on them because it was against the rules of engagement. So it just, you know, there was things that were restricting to where the war was harder to win the counterinsurgency battle.
Yeah, and you talk, I mean, you kind of, not to just transition into it, but, you know, the IEDs and the vehicle-borne IEDs, and that sort of led to the, you know, the April 10th, 2012, what happened then. And, you know, I know that people could kind of get the Cliff Notes version, but, you know, take us through that short period of, you know, that day in a short period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So we actually had the day off. We weren't supposed to go on a patrol that day. We were supposed to refit and take a break. And then we got a phone call that there was a improvised explosive device or a roadside bomb in the city. They wanted us to come check out with our explosive ordnance disposal team, EOD. So we went out there and walking along, swept the ground with the minesweeper like, you know, we did every day. If anything under the minesweeper alarmed us, we'd walk around it. Well, nothing alarmed us on the minesweeper, so I came to a short halt with my guys. So my backpack on the ground, and my backpack is about 80 to 120 pounds any given day. And we hit the ground, it went off, and underneath it was a bomb. And the bomb tore off my right arm at the bicep, my right leg at the knee joint. And they disintegrated those two pieces. They never found my hand or my foot. my left leg was snapped through the bone, so it was dangling down on my thigh, but it was still attached with muscle and tendon. And then my left arm was hurt really bad at the wrist, but I still had my thumb, index finger, and middle, and I could pinch them and use them. And my pinky and ring finger mangled up, still kind of there. And I hit the ground on the left side of my face. I rolled over my back, and, you know, I saw my leg hanging down on my thigh, my other leg completely gone, my right leg gone, my right arm gone, and then I used my left hand to call my LT, and I radioed my LT as an A6, as a 4, I just hit a bomb. I need, you know, your medic with mine. I got guys over here that are injured, and I had two guys that were injured, and my medic came up to me, and I told him, just, you know, don't worry about it. I said, you know, you can't do anything about this, so you might as well just go. And the medic said, let me do my job, and we got kind of an argument match, because I just thought, I've seen a lot of my friends go for a lot less, which is unfortunate, but it's the truth, so, you know, don't waste your time on me. And, you know, in my head, I kept saying, just don't be like Saving Private Ryan. I don't want to yell for my mom. I don't want to, you know, yell out in pain or fear. So I was just trying to stay as cool and calm as collected, to the point where my medic's got the tourniquets on him, and the other medic came up to me, Doc Voice, and he was like, you're going to be fine, Sergeant Mills, and kept trying to reassure me it was going to be okay. And that's what they're taught to do, but I think he was, you know, a little bit freaking out. So I said, Doc, just do your job. Shut up. I'll be fine. It's okay. And I had to, like, calm him down to do his job. He was doing his job great, but I just wanted to make sure he knew that I was verbally going to be okay. And then they got me on a helicopter, from the helicopter to the you know, the hospital to the operating table. And on the operating table, I was still awake and conscious and coherent, to the point where I kept saying, quit touching me, I'm fine. I got to get back to my guys. I just got to get my legs underneath me, and I kept trying to stand up. And a doctor had to basically chest up on me, like put his chest on mine to hold me down. And then they said, I don't know how you're still awake, Sergeant Mills. You need to go to sleep. And then they knocked me out. And as they knocked me out, the last thing I said, my little girl, am I ever going to see her again? Because I had a six-month-old at the time. And they went ahead and they knocked me out, and they put me into surgery for 14 hours. There was 9 doctors and 7 nurses that worked on me. 2 nurses for 9 hours pumped air in and out of my lungs to keep me stable and alive, and over 30 blood transfusions. And I just commend them on that. I mean, how amazing is that? Because really, they could have just opened one tourniquet for 2 minutes, and I would have bled out and died. But instead, they put all the time and effort, 14 hours worth, into me. And when they started to undress me on the operating table to work on me, my left leg came off with it, so I was a triple amputee. And then finally got me stable after 14 hours, and then I went to Bagram, Afghanistan on April 12th. They had to take me to surgery and look at the wounds, and my skin was dying around my hand, so they went ahead and had to cut my left hand off. So I was a quadruple amputee on that day, and then 2 days later, on April 14th, they woke me up for the very first time. And, you know, my brother-in-law had to be the one to tell me what had happened. He was there in Germany with me, and he told me that, you know, I said, my soldiers, how are my soldiers? And he said, you know, what was going on, who was where, and the guys got hurt, how they were doing. And I said, am I paralyzed? And he said, no. And I said, no, Josh, you can tell me. I can't feel my fingers and toes. And he said, you don't have them anymore. And it was point blank, but they didn't want to lie. He wanted to be direct with me and let me know. And I said, oh, okay. So, you know, that was my 25th birthday. April 14th was my 25th birthday. I found out I was a quadruple amputee. And then I didn't want to call him and talk to my wife or anything like that, or my mom and dad. I was pretty embarrassed and angry and upset, you know, questioning, am I a bad person? Does God hate me? What did I do wrong in life? And then, you know, I just had to call my wife. My brother-in-law made me call my wife and call my mom and dad. And I just was like, hey, what's up? I'm fine. See you when I get home. Love you. Bye. And I made it to the hospital, and they had to take me into emergency surgery on April 17th at Walter Reed. Cut my right leg off 2 inches higher. And then the next day I told my wife she should take everything we have, the house, the money, the cars, and go. And she's like, you know, I want to do that, but handicapped parking has me enticed. Which, that's a joke. Yeah, that's just more of a joke. She didn't say that. I just said, you know, you should probably take everything. And she said, that's not how this works. We're going to get through this together. And, I mean, you're looking at a guy that was 250 pounds to 140 pounds. I was 110 pounds, and I have no arms and legs. Why would my wife stay? But she did. She stayed, and we're still happily married to this day, going on 9 years of marriage. So I'm so thankful for that.
Yeah, I mean, the story is amazing. Pick up the book. I hate to be the you know, the huckster of books, but there's more to it than we can get into in this brief time. But is the quickness of the battlefield, getting somebody from the helicopter to the hospital and to Bagram to, you know, Germany and to Walter Reed. I mean, back in Civil War days, they just had morphine in a towel, and they're like, you know, we'll figure it out. Maybe you live, maybe you don't.
Oh, absolutely. And then let me just say that's something that we've done right. The Kandahar Hospital has a 99% chance of living. If you make it to Kandahar alive on the helicopter, you will leave there alive. 99% chance. That's how good they are nowadays with their medical advancements and keeping people stable and alive so that they can live live a fulfilling full life.
Yeah, that's great. And so just to get back to the, you know, you did all kinds of rehab. One of your goals was to walk again. Kind of take us to the teamwork that goes into rehabbing our soldiers and getting them to back to where they want to be, their goals, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you go and start working out, and you lost so much muscle mass. For me in general, I lost 110 pounds. And then they say, you know, let's set some goals for you. So, like, I wanted to have a hand and be able to feed myself again and do things by myself and dress myself and other things by myself. So I healed up. Within 5 weeks, I had a hand, and I was feeding myself again, and I was working on dressing myself and all that. And then I wanted to be able to walk again. I was tired of not tired of it, but I knew there was guys walking that, and I just thought I better learn how to do it. So 7 weeks and 4 days, I took my very first steps at Walter Reed. It was very painful. It wasn't easy, but I was able to do it. And then I just kept working every day harder and harder and harder. And I turned my physical therapy and occupational therapy into a job. And it went from an hour a day of each to 2 hours to 3 to 4 hours of each. So I was doing 8 hours a day of therapy for, 40 hours a week, basically, of therapy.
In overtime.
And yeah, yep. And then just trying to do all I could to get better. And then I would, at nighttime, I'd go home to my apartment that they have, like the housing that they have for you on Walter Reed campus. And my wife and my daughter were there. And I'd strap my daughter to the wheelchair, and we'd go run around, give my wife a break for an hour or two. And Chloe and I would go drive around and hang out in other people's rooms and just kind of see how everybody was doing. I became known as the mayor of Building 62. That's where all the guys live. And since I was an E6, but a lot of guys get hurt are privates, if they had any issues, I'd say, you guys got any problems going on, anything I can help you with? And they would tell me about, this issue or that, and I would try to take care of it, because where they were afraid to talk to their squad leader, they were called their E6 squad leader that outranked them, I had no problem talking to them and letting them know that if they don't get their stuff fixed, that we can go talk to the first sergeant together. And they didn't like that, but I didn't care what they thought about me, because I was there for my guys that were injured, so whatever.
I like it. And so the other principle that I loved in the book is that no problem or obstacle is small or big. Everybody has a different kind of thing and is going after one common goal of getting back to where they want to be. How important is it to have a good group of people around you to get to that goal?
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a big part of my recovery was the people that were around me. Matter of fact, I started a nonprofit where we bring people in and we try to build networks for them, maybe because they don't have a network. So what we do is we take combat injured veterans from Afghanistan or Iraq, and then we bring in them and their families for a week in Maine, and we for free, and we show them that there's other people out there like them. So we have up to 8 families come and let them just kind of build that network of friendship and try new things adaptively so they can do things, with their families that live life on the sidelines. And I think that a big part of my recovery was because I had such a strong group of friends at Walter Reed. I had my wife by my side, my daughter looking up to me. And, I'm just fortunate that I had those people in that place, and that I had the willpower and drive to get better with my wife and my daughter cheering me on. And another thing, I go around and I speak for a living. I'm actually a motivational speaker and inspirational speaker, whatever you want to call it. And I go to these big companies like Allstate and Wells Fargo or whatever, just whatever, And when I go there, my two important things about the book I tell people about, the memoir we're talking about, Tough As They Come, I tell them there's two things in the author's note that you need to know. One, I didn't serve any more than anybody else. I raised my right hand, I took the oath like everybody else, and I was proud to do it, but I don't think I'm any more special. I didn't serve any more, and if you served, thank you for your service. And that goes for your listeners. If they served or you have a loved one that served, thank them from me or thank you for your service. And the next thing I tell them, I don't think my problem's any more than anybody else's. I think we all have something that, we consider a problem, and we try to get through it and past it. And if my story can help, please pass it along. And it's just important people know that. I don't think that my problems outweigh anything that they have going on. It's just, it is what it is. And I found a way to get through all my situation to where now, I found out I can reminisce the past, but don't dwell on it, because I can't change it. And also, I can always affect my attitude. I can't always affect my situation. So I might as well take every situation and make sure my attitude's the right attitude in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. And And I love what you're transitioning into and helping families and the veterans, you know, get reintegrated and kind of share the problems that and the struggles and the successes and all that great stuff. So the other thing that I liked in the book and just kind of reading the articles that have been written about you is, I'm in the same boat. I don't like the term disabled veteran. I don't know. I just leave this kind of like, well, I don't know, that they seem to be doing okay to me, and they're pretty smart guys and girls and all that. So I want to come up with a better term. What do you think what would be a term that we could come up with?
Yeah, when I travel, everybody's like, you're one of those wounded warriors. And I'm like, I'm not wounded anymore. So I'm just, you know, I'm going by Travis, but if you want to call me something, I put it in the book too. It's recalibrated warrior, I guess. Cause I just, you know, wounded just entail, like, it makes it sound like I'm still injured, you know, like, oh, you're wounded. Oh no. Like, I'm like, no, I'm not wounded. I am fully, I have scars, awesome scars. Unfortunately, ladies, I am married, so you cannot see them. But I, you know, I get, we coined the term recalibrated warrior, but I really just, I go by Travis usually. That's my wife calling me something that I can't say on, you know, the podcast. But, that's more of a joke, by the way. But anyway, you know, I just, yeah, so I don't go by wounded warrior. I don't appreciate the fact that people automatically look at me and they have pity in their eyes right off the bat, because, you know, I don't think I'm any worse off. I'm the same person I was before. I drive my daughter to school. Matter of fact, after I get off this wonderful show here, I got to pick my daughter up from her after school program where she does karate, and then I'm going to take her home. My wife's going to make dinner, or we're going to go out to dinner, one of the two. So I live a pretty normal life.
Yeah, that's awesome. And getting back to the Travis Mills Foundation, you know, how could people support? I mean, what kind of activities, you know, what's the goal of things to have? I saw some recreational sports you guys want to have. I hope some sort of football game is included in that.
Well, I mean, if they're able to play football, then absolutely. We have that. We have a lot of water sports. Like, we're on the lake, so kayaking, canoeing, boating, tubing, fishing, swimming. But it's just about bringing the family together, because, you know what, it wasn't just me going through something. My wife was too. My wife's on a text chain with six of her closest friends from Walter Reed, the wives of other soldiers. And I mean, they talk about anything and everything every day, all day long. I mean, my wife's been talking to them about things going on in her life, or one of the other wives will ask a question about shoes for an event, or they'll talk about, you know, my wife's pregnant right now. So that my wife told them before she told a lot of other people that we were expecting a baby and things like that. So just to have the families come out and know that, you know what, you're not alone. Here's other, you know, wives or husbands in your situation. Here's other children to play with that have the same thing with their dad, so they don't feel like maybe they got shorted or it's not fair. Their dad's the only one around that has no legs or has one leg missing or an arm missing. And it just, it's a real time for people to come together and understand that life goes on. You know, don't ever sit around feeling sorry for yourself, and just here's activities that you can do with your family, and you can be out there with them on the water. And we want to provide that service so that not only you get to try it, but you get to take the knowledge home of how to do it when you get back to where you live.
That's incredible. And the website is travismills.org. That's travismills.org. And it's a clean website that you can click and find all the information about what Travis was talking and all the other things that we sort of talked about. So I got one final question, and I couldn't let the podcast go without having a little shout out to the Vassar Vulcans. So I want to know, a similar adrenaline rush in scoring a touchdown in the playoffs or jumping out of the plane with the airborne, 82nd Airborne?
Oh boy, I tell you what, probably the same. You know, I score touchdowns like it's my job, and then I jumped out of airplanes because it was my job. So I guess it's the same. No, no, they're probably about the same. I tell you, there's nothing like a firefight, but I'm not recommending anybody out there goes and gets in a firefight, because that's not what I'm recommending here. But no, I was fortunate to have a really good high school football and baseball and basketball career, if you will, and then I went on to play a little bit of college football. And jumping out of airplanes was just another day at work for me. It was really fun. I was actually trained so I could check people's equipment, and if they didn't want to go out the door, but they were secure to go out the door and they were safe, And they said, no, I'm not jumping today. I just kick them out because, you know what? You're airborne. It's what you're going to do. I had to throw one kid out and kick another kid out, but only twice. And they landed fine, I think. So we're good. But I really appreciate you having me. Like you said earlier, TravisMills.org. If you guys want to help me out with social media, if you type into your search bar on Facebook, SSG Travis Mills, my site will pop up. My Facebook page, if you will. Hit like and share for your friends and just help this good time rolling. Keep rolling. We really appreciate it here.
And I love the jokes. When are you headlining in Vegas?
You know, they haven't called me yet. Something about I won't wear sparkles, I guess. I thought maybe they'd let me get away with it, the rhinestones, but I don't know. We'll see. We'll figure it all out. I should be next year probably headlining in Vegas.
I like it. Well, finally, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to the Valor Podcast. Make sure to like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play or any podcast management app. Visit our webpage at thevalorpodcast.com. That's thevalorpodcast.com. Finally, find your mission. There are many veteran organizations, nonprofits, and veterans needing your help. I promise you'll make some great friends, and go check out travismills.org and find out how to get involved in that. I promise you'll make some great friends and some great memories. Thanks again, and have a great week.